the Mentors Podcast, where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Today's guest is Nicole Gregory, author of God's Messenger, The Astounding Achievements of Mother Cabrini, a Catholic nun who founded the Missionary Sisters of the Sacred Heart of Jesus and was the first naturalized citizen of the United States to be canonized by the Roman Catholic Church. What I love about her is that she's the patron saint of immigrants, and my own grandparents were Italian immigrants who arrived in the decades right after her death. Welcome, Nicole.
Hi.
It's so great to have you here.
It's nice to be here.
We're going to start with the question I generally start with, which is, why does Mother Cabrini matter to us today?
Well, for a number of reasons. One being is that she was an advocate for immigrants in a time when there was a lot of discrimination against Italian immigrants in particular. She arrived in New York at about 1889-1890 when the conditions in which immigrants lived were just appalling. They lived in small tenements, 20 families to an apartment. There was rampant disease. The Italian men who came over got jobs that were just very dangerous, the most dangerous that there were in New York. And anyway, she identified the needs right away, and she plunged in with her meager funds to help immigrants, and she ultimately traveled all over the country and then all over the world to help immigrants. And it couldn't be more timely given the conditions we are in today.
I find that very true, which is also what makes this a very timely topic, I believe.
Yes.
Oh, thank you so much. Okay, so what do you think about what, besides immigration, what were the big issues that she had to then deal with? Because I know she worked both with orphans and in hospital work.
Well, she just threw herself into it. I mean, really, her goal as a young woman was to go to China. She had a very romantic idea about being a missionary. And yet she was, when this situation came to her attention about the treatment of Italians who had immigrated to New York, she realized there was a calling, there was a huge need. So she came over to New York, and it was just a disaster in her mind. I mean, she had very little money. She had about six other very young nuns with her. They had no money. So they immediately plunged in by creating a little space that they lived in, and then they started teaching children. They started, whenever they begged for money and got any that they could give away, they did. They were hungry themselves. So, I mean, the miracle of Mother Cabrini is how she created something out of nothing wherever she went. And by the way, she went to other Catholic orders who were already established in New York, and they turned her down initially. They didn't give her any money or any support.
It's fascinating that she didn't receive any help from the other orders. Was there a reason for that? Was she not yet established, or they didn't believe in what she was doing?
I think it was partly because she was a woman, and she faced discrimination as a woman from the get-go. I think it was also because she was barely established, and they didn't feel like giving her money if they weren't sure she was going to actually stay. So she had to fight on all fronts to do what she felt she was called to do.
Who began as her benefactor then? Which groups or what? In what way did she finally get a toehold in things?
She was very quick and very smart. She was a very well-educated young woman, and she immediately identified wealthy Italians who lived in New York, and she found her way to them. She did have an entree in Bishop Corrigan of New York at that time, who connected her to the Cesnola family, and the wife of the couple was very dedicated to the idea of creating an orphanage for Italian orphans, Italian immigrant orphans.
Interesting. So she started, I know she started as a teacher and then got into the orphanage work because of the teaching?
No, she was a teacher in Italy. That was how she supported herself and, by the way, her sister and brother. And when she came to New York, teaching was just one of the things that she did initially. But she had a special interest in educating girls because she could see that when girls were educated, they would have a chance at making money other than some horrible way. And so she was very dedicated to teaching, but she was very dedicated to saving these orphans from death because diseases were rampant in New York. And so adults were dying and these children were on the street. Her first concern was simply to save lives. And then once she started a little school, children could come, they could eat there if they had food. And all the nuns that came with her were also teachers.
Interesting. So at what point did they finally become a group that was respected or supported in New York?
It was pretty early on because of the help of the Countess Cesnola. She connected Mother Cabrini to other wealthy Italian families. Her husband, by the way, was very wealthy. He had gotten some artifacts from an anthropological dig, I think, in Turkey, and he ultimately became the first director of the Metropolitan Museum.
And Louis Cesnola, I know.
Exactly,
him, yes.
Yes. And so through her, she developed money. They created their first little orphanage in the East 50s in New York, which Bishop Corrigan thought was a terrible idea. I thought it was the wrong place for orphans to be in this classy neighborhood. And indeed, he was right. It was just too small. So it was really the coordinated help of the Countess, Mother Cabrini, and other wealthy Italians with the help of Bishop Corrigan. So the first one was on East 59th, and then they spread out to other parts of the city.
And at some point, she ends up moving to Chicago.
Well, yes, she traveled all over the U.S. She went to Chicago, she went to Denver, she went to New Orleans, she went to Seattle, she went to Los Angeles, she went to Burbank.
What did she leave behind in Los Angeles, since that's where we're sitting as we talk?
She started an orphanage here. I don't know if that is still in existence as a building. I don't think so. But she loved Los Angeles because she was ill her whole life. She had respiratory illnesses, and Los Angeles was good for her, a good environment for her. She did start another orphanage in Burbank, and that ultimately turned into a school. And I think there is a Cabrini library that's part of a little college out there.
That's beautiful. That's an amazing amount of work. And what's interesting, what I'm hearing you saying, is that it was her and wealthy Italians, but it seems to be the wealthy Italian wives. So it seems to be a female-founded organization above and beyond simply the other nuns with her.
As far as I have read, she was super clever, and she had no trouble shaming men in the church and out of the church who wouldn't give her money. And she would say, this is for orphans and you're not going to give me money. And so she had a way of getting around them. You could say it's manipulation, but basically she was shaming them into not contributing to her cause, and it worked.
I like her already. That's interesting, because my next question is, what talents did she bring to this cause? So we have manipulation, which is not a bad talent, but what were her other talents?
Well, she was very strong-willed, and I have to say that one thing I discovered in my research is that I think that becoming a nun was a safe place for women at that time, a long time ago, in the 1800s, because she could be educated, she could be somewhat independent, she still, you know, went by what the Pope asked her to do, for sure. She was very devoted to the Pope. But she could be as smart as she wanted, and she could create things like this. I mean, of course, she had to get approval from all the men in the church, but she could do that. And so it was a good place for her. She was very, as I said, she was very strong-willed. She was very determined. She had a strong spiritual belief that she was meant to do this. So she wouldn't let obstacles get in her way, including her own illness. And she was unafraid. So when families were sick from various diseases, such as yellow fever, she and her nuns went right in and ministered to the families. Sometimes they got sick too, and a few of them did die as a result. But she believed that it was their calling to help these immigrant families.
That's an amazing thing to see in a person, to spend her whole life in that dedication.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the more I read, the more I admired her. Yellow fever kind of swept through New Orleans a couple of times. And she had established a school and an orphanage there, and the nuns alerted her to what was going on, and she went, but they administered. And the reason why Italians in particular were affected were that they worked on the docks. The mosquitoes were attracted to the fruit that they were unloading, and so the Italians really were hit hard by the yellow fever, and Mother Cabrini and her nuns helped them.
I've never heard that particular story. I've heard a lot about yellow fever and the various epidemics, but I've never heard about it attacking the Italian-American population in that way.
Yes, and there's another thing that happened in New Orleans that most people have never heard about, which I had not heard about, was that there was a lynching of a whole group of Italians who'd been accused of shooting, I think it may have been the sheriff or something like someone like that, and they were acquitted by a jury. But before they could even get released from the jail, a mob swept through, dragged, I think, 13 of them out and killed them.
That's so interesting because I happen to know that, which always sounds like, oh yeah, you made that up. But it's in a book about Frank Sinatra that I read years ago, and I never lost the fact that the largest mass lynching in America was of Italian Americans.
Yes.
Who knew? I mean,
who knew?
And to think, she was in the area at that time?
No, she wasn't. She was actually in Italy when it happened, but she read about it, and she was devastated, as were all Italian immigrants all over America, because they realized that they were in danger all the time.
That's such an amazing thing. It's always so interesting to try to explain that to students because, of course, that wave of immigration has passed and Italians are relatively assimilated to the culture, so people forget about that piece of their history.
Yes, and there's a book that I came across that I would highly recommend, which is called Strangers in the Land, Patterns of American Nativism, which was written in 1953. And it's basically tracks that kind of thinking of fear and loathing of immigrants in America. And there were waves of it constantly. And so it's not just new what we're experiencing now. There were laws in various states that prohibited immigrants from becoming lawyers or doctors or holding any government positions. She was facing something that happened regularly in the United States.
But now how interesting, as a woman, she wouldn't have generally been allowed to be a lawyer or a doctor anyway. So in a weird way, she skirted some of the discrimination, but did she face any in terms of her being an Italian?
Yes. I think a lot of Catholics looked down on her because she was a woman, and people got in her way because she wanted to be the head of a hospital or the head of a school. They didn't like that. So in certain cities, I think particularly in Seattle, she ran into trouble because she was the head of a hospital.
That's, I would say amazing, but not amazing, obviously, based on the time. But amazing that she continued through all of that.
Yes, and let me just say that in New York, when she established the first big hospital, there were a couple of smaller ones. But the first big one, she got major doctors and surgeons throughout the city to donate their time and expertise to help establish this hospital. And what was so amazing is that she recognized that Italians who didn't speak English, who got sick, didn't feel comfortable talking to doctors, didn't feel comfortable going to an English-speaking hospital. And so she saw that need. And there were other doctors in the city who recognized that need too, and they helped her establish this really fine hospital. And so that perhaps was one of the biggest services that she provided for immigrants. And she did that in cities all over the country.
Was she available then to have translators? Did she use nuns as translators with the doctors?
Yes, there were some nuns who obviously spoke several languages and served as translators. And in Chicago, she established a very big hospital that way. And actually, I think in Denver and Seattle as well.
That is something that you don't even think about, the concept of wanting to communicate with your doctor. And then who would imagine that was something you could provide that would give better treatment?
Yes, absolutely.
I love that. Oh, mm-hmm. I love that. Sometimes it's so fun learning all these new things. Well, now I'm going to sort of switch us into this, the big thing that makes her famous among, because many nuns did come and did establish orphanages and do good work. But Mother Cabrini is the first one to be canonized. Mm-hmm. So what is this process of becoming a saint, and how did she get put on that track? Who was her supporter at that?
Yeah, that was all very much after her death. And from what I understand, this is a very long process. Mm-hmm. And there have to be two miracles that are attributed to her. You would think that the works that she did in the United States and around the world would be miracles enough based on the fact that she had practically no support. But they picked two events that happened long after she died that were related to her. I guess that was because that was the process that was necessary. I can tell you about the miracles that they attributed to her.
Sure, for fun. I mean, okay. Because I understand that that's true. You need to have people who pray to you, and then a miracle happens, and they deem it to be a miracle, and then it gets credited to you, and that's how you go on this track.
It's true. It's a little bit bizarre. There was a baby boy in a hospital, I think in New York, who was being treated by a nurse. Apparently, they would always put these certain drops of some kind of medicine in baby's eyes, and this nurse dropped the whole bottle of medicine, basically blinding the baby. It was an infant, and someone placed on the baby's clothing, pinned to his clothing, a little picture of Mother Cabrini. And in something like 48 hours, the doctors determined that he was able to see again. That was one miracle. I tracked that baby, and he grew up to become a priest, interestingly.
Of course. If you were raised all your life being told that a miracle happened, you might be interested in that job.
Yeah, kind of cool. And the other one was a woman who was dying of cancer of, I think, the stomach. And she had a dream that Mother Cabrini told her to eat a big meal, which is not what the doctors were telling her. And she arranged to get herself a big, hearty meal, which she ate and digested successfully and recovered from the cancer completely.
Very interesting.
Yes.
Well, miracles are miracles because we can't trace where they happen, what caused them.
Exactly, so. Yeah.
Interesting. But then crediting them to her allowed her to have this great honor.
Yes, very great honor.
Wow, that's so cool. Well, so while you were researching her, besides these very interesting miracles, what would you say was the most interesting thing you found out about her life, or perhaps a very interesting piece of research that no one knew existed?
Well, there have been several books written about her. Some are very academic and some are very, quote unquote, popular. So popular that I'm not sure what's true in them and what isn't true. One of the things that really interested me was that she crossed the Andes by foot. And the reason why is that she was traveling with a companion. Apparently, all the nuns, whenever they went anywhere, they traveled in twos or threes. And so she had a companion who was deathly afraid of traveling by water, and they had to go to Buenos Aires. They were traveling down Central and South America. And so Mother Cabrini, in deference to her companion, said, okay, well, we can go by ship and go all the way around, or we can cross over the Andes. Which would you like to do? And the young nun said, let's go over the Andes, not even knowing what she was saying. So they traveled by train up, as far as the train went. They got off, they got on some donkeys. Some local Dominicans gave them fur jackets. They went by donkey with a guide up, as far as they could go by donkey. And then at one point there was a crevasse and everyone had to jump over the crevasse. And Mother Cabrini took a flying leap and almost fell into the crevasse. One of the guides caught her, pulled her up, and she fainted into a snow drift.
Oh.
And she awoke and kind of pulled herself together, and everyone else jumped over the crevasse. I don't know what they did with the donkeys, but anyway, the whole entourage got over the other side, and eventually, after weeks, they went down into Buenos Aires, where they went in and had to search for a contact that they had, a friend of a friend of a friend, and they established themselves in Buenos Aires.
Man, that was post-New York City.
Yes.
Yes.
Wow. Very post.
So she went across all the Americas.
Yes.
That's amazing travel for a woman from that time period.
Another book that I looked at quite a bit was a book that was her diary from all her ocean voyages. And she apparently crossed the ocean something like 23 times. And when you think about that, there are many descriptions of horrible storms that came up where everybody thought, this was it, we're dead. And she ministered to her nuns when that happened, and she also went below deck to the lowest decks and ministered to the poorest people who were afraid. So she really encountered death many times, or the prospect of death many times, and she relied on her faith in Jesus every single time, apparently. I mean, she didn't want to die, obviously, and of course she got scared like anyone else, but she held on to her faith each time.
And that gave her the strength. That's so beautiful. Wow. So who would you say were her mentors in life? What got her on this path?
Interestingly, I didn't find many women who were mentors to her. She really loved Pope Leo XIII. And according to what I've read, he was an extremely kind pope. And she came to visit him a few times, which was a big deal. You had to make appointments and appointments and appointments.
And a woman visiting.
It was a big deal. They thought she was good as a local nun in Italy. Why not stay that way? But her fervor got through to him, and he sensed it. And so he kind of opened doors for her. He listened to her, first of all, and she loved that. He was kind. He understood the plight of Italian immigrants all around the world. He saw her fervor to help them, and he opened the doors and gave her his blessing, gave her his kindness, his support, and that filtered down to all the other people who had to make it happen for her to travel.
That's brilliant. I mean, that was the main person to get approval from, and yeah. She knew that.
Yes.
That just shows her savvy from a very early age.
Yes, but I would say also it began with her parents. Her father in particular really believed in education for all his children. Her parents were farmers in northern Italy, and they were very generous, though they were very careful to save money, so they were actually prosperous and generous. They worked very hard, but her dad in particular seemed to really believe in education, and so she was sent to a little school early on, as soon as she could go to, let's see, I think it was a school for nuns when she was a young teenager. And so, in a way, he was one of her mentors.
That's a beautiful thing, having two males, essentially, as what we call nowadays allies.
Yes.
In this goal of this particular girl.
Yes, for sure.
What moved her to become a nun?
Supposedly, she had a couple of spiritual experiences when she was very little. And she loved church. Her parents took their children to church all the time. She adored church. It was very much part of their life. Her father read the Bible at night to everyone. And apparently religion, the way it was given to her as a child, was very nice and loving. And so she never had any negative associations with religion or church or the authorities. I think she perceived that nuns had a pathway with education that other young girls in her village didn't. And I also think there is a story that really rang true of her seeing a missionary who spoke in her town, in the town square, who talked about going to China and going to people who had never heard about Jesus and spreading the word of Jesus. And that really inspired her. As a young girl, you can imagine, she got this very romantic notion of going to exotic lands and kind of freeing people. And it never stopped from there.
I love that. So before you began writing about her, did you have an impression of her? Did you have any prior knowledge about who she was?
I know her name because Cabrini is a pretty well-known name in certain cities. I think the Cabrini Hospital in New York has closed, but I knew there was a Cabrini Hospital Cabrini Green in Chicago. So I had just heard her name. I figured she was a nun, but I had no real understanding of her. And then when I started to research her, I'd see these very formal portraits of her with a kind of a grim expression. So I was really curious, like, who is the person behind this kind of formal looking nun?
That's the interesting part of writing about anyone's life, getting into all those details. And I do think that we misunderstand nuns because, of course, media has made jokes about them and the rulers and all the things. And I grew up going to Catholic school. And then I also worked with nuns later in my life. And the high level of education and the high level of commitment that they always show is such an amazing thing. Mm-hmm. And to think you could have it back in the day when women didn't have any real power.
That's right.
And yet, today, we're still talking about educating women with Oprah Winfrey opening her school in Africa and all the power that you can bring to a village if you give the women that power.
Yes.
So to think that she recognized that 100 and some years before Oprah. How could you know more than Oprah?
Well, I think she saw in all these places that she went, she really saw what happened to girls who had no education, and it was bad. And I think she probably saw that in her own little village. And, you know, girls got married very young, they had lots of children, and they could die young. I'm pretty sure she just said no to that lifestyle, and becoming a nun suited her personality, and it was a way that she could do what she wanted to do.
And I know that in other famous stories of nuns, that tended to be the way out of those kinds of situations and the way to be a leader in an acceptable societal way.
That's right.
Which is always so interesting. If we could prove they could be leaders in their convents, they really ought to have done that in bigger places. But we're still arguing that now. How funny. Considering she's been deemed a saint, were there any unsaintly traits or habits that she had? Was there anything she was trying to overcome in her life, maybe a jealousy or envy or anything that was bothering her about?
I'd say she was probably really bossy. She was maybe abrupt to people. She didn't suffer fools gladly. And so she was a very practical person. I mean, I think the whole idea of a saint is a romanticization of a person. When she was very dogged in her beliefs, and she was very practical. So she knew all about money. She knew all about how to raise money to build a hospital. She was very keen on sustaining these places with donations. A lot of her work was like basic fundraising. I'd say that was most of her work. And everywhere she went, she had to do that, including, you know, Central and South America, because she established a place in Panama and Nicaragua. So one thing I would say, though, is that once she did meet wealthy people, she could turn on the charm like that. And when she did all these cross-Atlantic voyages, she went to the first class, and she sat with the first class. And there was nothing else to do but sit and chat, and she would regale them with stories of orphanages and how she had helped these poor children, or, you know, children who'd been abandoned and were sick, and she brought them up and gave them education. And so she would convey these stories, and from what I understand, the rich people would like pull out their wallets and hand over cash right on the spot. So she knew how to work her crowd. She knew where to find them. She was really good at that. I don't know whether you'd call that saintly or not, but she was practical. She knew how, she wasn't just a woman with a vision. She had some very practical ways of making her vision become reality.
That's what makes for success.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Are there any stories about particular orphans that she helped that grew up to be prominent people, or were there some that stayed involved and obviously became nuns with her?
Yes, from what I understand, a lot of the young women who were orphans who went through the orphanages that she established then became nuns. They obviously saw it was a pathway for other young women, and they wanted to follow. But she was also very intent on teaching young women and these young nuns skills like embroidery and needlepoint, and they would sell that. They would go to shows. There was a big show in the Pacific Northwest, like an exhibition that was famous in the early 1900s, and they put their needlework on display. So she was very proud of that. And so she taught them how to kind of get along in the world. And I think the young nuns really were attracted to that, and they saw a path for themselves. They saw a future for themselves.
When was her order established?
It was established in Italy, I guess, probably in the early 1880s. I don't know the exact date, but it was established in Italy first. She was sent initially to a place called the House of Providence, which was a school, they call it a novitiate, and she had a terrible experience there. The women who ran it were nasty to her, nasty to the girls, and because she stayed there, even though it was a harsh place, the bishops in the area allowed her to start her own order. And that was like a dream come true for her. But it happened in Italy first.
Right. And then she brought those groups here to the States.
She spread out a little bit in northern Italy. She also established a foundation in Rome. And they thought she was good there. So when she first brought up the idea of going to America, most of the bishops who she had to answer to said, no, you're good here. We need you here. Don't think so big.
Don't think so big. Oh, lovely. What a thing to tell someone. Don't think big thoughts. It's okay. We'll think them for you.
Yes, exactly.
Well, that makes sense back in the day. Wow. So from a writing standpoint, was there a scene that you particularly had fun creating because you were able to use some of her actual dialogue from a letter, or was it a moment you really enjoyed fashioning?
Well, I loved reading her letters that she wrote to her sisters when she was on the ocean. She got to see aurora borealis. She got to see fierce storms. She got to see stars. She got to see glaciers in the, you know, glowing in the night. And her writing about them really is a kind of a mixture of poetry and kind of spiritual, I don't know, just reverie. And I really liked kind of fitting that into the story, because she wanted her sisters to feel everything that she felt. She wanted very much to bring everybody, all of them along with her. And she also wanted to exhort them to do their best. So I really liked recreating conversations that with her sisters and these moments on the boat where she had these kind of intense spiritual experiences because of nature.
That makes me want to read them. That's always a good thing. Wonderful. Well, then I'm going to end with what I always end with, which is, who were the mentors in your life?
Oh, my gosh. I wasn't expecting that question. I went to Sarah Lawrence College, And because it was a women's college, and I suppose I identify with Mother Cabrini in this way, women were, that we had a few male students when I went there, but women were very much free to learn what they wanted to learn and say what they wanted to say and speak up without fear of being shut down by male students or male teachers. And it was a great school for me. And there were a couple of teachers there who, I don't know if I would call them exactly mentors, but I really focused on as being really wonderful people who had a way of thinking that I liked.
That's a beautiful way to define a mentor. Well, that's a beautiful way. And I want to thank you so much for coming with us today.
My pleasure.
It's been a great conversation.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Rosanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.